It'd be interesting to hear some thoughts as we begin. In terms of cultural view of emotions, what kind of things do you talk about there? Start with the girls. Sorry, that just sounds stereotype now, but you know what I mean. Okay, X Factor. Yeah, hugely emotional sort of sob stories on the X Factor and Britain's Got Talent. So, yeah. Other stuff you talked about? Just X Factor. Okay. So quite a lot about crying, not negative emotions necessarily, but sad emotions. You guys, culture and emotion. Yeah. Okay. It would seem to be. Sorry, anything brilliant insightful you want to check in before?
I mentioned that.
Bet he did. Yeah. Good. I think it's probably fair to say that at least in Britain, whilst we've got the sort of theoretical stereotype of stiff upper lip and we don't show any emotion, we're British and all the rest of it, perhaps in the last few years, some people put the funeral of Diana as a bit of at least a sort of marker point, if not a turning point. We've got much more used to public showing of grief, at least, as an emotion. So the way grief was expressed at the funeral of Diana versus the funeral of, say, Churchill, incredibly different. There's lots of respect for Churchill, just as many people on the streets, but in terms of, you know, writing personal names, you meant so much to me, and they're just worlds apart. So I think Britain is probably in a bit of a weird place. Maybe some of it's generational, at least at a surface level, a culture in a country that's been known for being pretty uptight in the last, say, 15 years or so, as evidenced by all these sort of TV programmes, at a pop culture level, yeah, it seems to be much more upfront about emotion. In terms of your experience of emotion in the church, whether the church tend to be sort of pro or against or that sort of thing, what do you talk about there? Let's start this end. Okay. Have people sort of experienced extremes within church life? I don't know, we all come from different backgrounds, I guess, but... Right. Yeah. You mean it's not us? Yeah. Guess that. In terms of people's church backgrounds, do you think you've tended to be in churches that are verging towards too emotional or verging towards not emotional enough? Or potentially more or less getting it right? A lot. It's interesting when we all have different church backgrounds, but on the whole, when you get people who are from more conservative churches theologically, quite often when they get speaking, there's a kind of, I'm not sure we're emotional enough. Now, maybe right, maybe wrong, but at least at the impression level, that's often the way. And again, if we're caricaturing somewhat, then it's often seems to be the case at a presentational level that oh, the churches that are perhaps have less Bible, but are more emotionally, at least outwardly, on show, and the churches that are sort of high priority for Bible tend to be a bit buttoned up. Now, we won't try and discover whether that's true or not tonight. That's not exactly where I'm going. But even just as we begin a series trying to work out the right place for emotions in the Christian life, what is it like to be fully human? What kind of people are we meant to be? Some of you might be thinking, oh, finally, you know, we can sort of get on with being real human beings, expressing our emotions. This is what I've been waiting for. Others of you are going to possibly be thinking, oh, really? Emotions? You know, can't we just think straight and then everything will follow? I just think both are caricatures, essentially. Particularly on that question of Christ-likeness. This is the one. When you think about Christ-likeness, what do you think? Someone says, I'm going to give you a talk on being Christ-like. What would you think the talk was going to be on? Okay, self-sacrifice. Yeah. Holiness. Yep. That would be normally the way we think about Christ-likeness, isn't it? Holiness. How can I live my life more like Christ? So self-sacrifice, service, and holiness, just being pure. And of course, that's all true. We are meant to be like Christ in those ways. But one of the things that I suppose sparked some of the thoughts of this series, and the original idea was Matt, was that actually Christ demonstrates to us in his humanity that the way to be fully human, and as we'll see just a little bit later in the evening, one of the things the Gospels present us with is not just the right teachings of Jesus, okay, where he tells us the right way to think, not just right behaviour, but also how he responds emotionally in various different situations. So if we're going to be fully Christ-like, we need to become like him, not just in how he thinks and how he acts, but also how he feels about situations, his emotional life, if you like. I put down there, created for colour. Lots of this early stuff, just to confess straight away, I've pinched from a book by Graham Bynum called Emotions, imaginatively, Living in Colour. It's a really good book. You can't borrow this one because then I'll be stuck for next week. But in about 3 weeks, when we've dealt with most of this stuff, you can borrow it, or worth getting hold of. I think it's a really, really helpful book. Graham did Bible Week about 3 years ago, was it? Something like that. Really good guy, and I think has a really balanced approach to this stuff. And the subtitle of his book is Living Life in Colour. And in the introduction, really, he talks about the stereotypes. It's, you know, one hand, you've got the kind of Mr. Spock approach to the Christian life, where you just have to process everything rightly. And as long as I get my doctrine right, that's all that matters. A slightly softer version of that might be that, although I'm not anti-emotions, I sort of think that they will basically look after themselves. So my job is to hear the Bible correctly, understand it correctly, think correctly, and then from that, emotions will just kind of happen. So this kind of person, they're not exactly against emotions. They don't just see them as dangerous and sort of things to be suppressed, but they just think they're not really that important. They should just flow from a right way of thinking. The second one, I suppose, is better, at least acknowledges that emotions have a place. But I still don't think it's quite right. Take, for example, the place of behaviour in the Christian life. Okay, we know, I guess, that if we really understand the gospel, we will behave rightly. Okay, we'll do the right things. So self-sacrifice is a classic example. In Mark 10, when Jesus says, even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and give his life as a ransom for many. He's using it as a way of motivating James and John to serve, to give their life sacrificially rather than to hunt for glory. So the principle is, if I understand the gospel correctly, well, then I'll live a godly life. But when you look at the New Testament, Jesus' teaching, Paul's teaching, any of the letters, they always go on and actually spell out what that godly life should look like. So Paul never writes a letter where he just explains the gospel and then puts, you know, lots of love, Paul, at the end, and expects the Corinthians or whoever just to work out how they should live. Now, he bothers to actually detail, and therefore you should live like this. There should be no sexual morality. You need to be generous. You need to be kind. He actually spells out the implications for acting. And so I think it's the same with emotions. Just because they come ultimately from a a sort of deeper understanding of the gospel, so understanding always comes first, doesn't mean they're not things we should actually think about and work on. We've seen in Philippians in particular that that an emotional reaction, for want of a better word, is something that is bound up in the commands that Paul gives.
So just interestingly, joy is that one of the big themes in Philippians. Philippians 1, verse 20, where am I? 25. Paul says this, convinced of this. Here's the key bit. I know that I will remain and continue with you all for your progress and your joy in the faith, so that in me you may have ample cause to glory in Christ Jesus. Why does Paul want to hang around, not die? Why does he want to hang around so we can come back to the Philippians? Well, both so they can progress in the faith, we'd expect him to say that, but also so they can have joy. So Paul is interested in their joy, which in broad categories is obviously an emotion. So just as there are commands to rejoice and indeed commands to weep and mourn and all the rest, the emotional side of our Christlikeness is one that can just easily slip off the radar. And I think that's going to lead to imbalance. If you've been around from the beginning of Christchurch, you'll know that we've got these 3D values, which really are just trying to shape the church culture. We haven't talked about them for a while, but one of the sort of sets of three, are these three dimensions, answering the question, what sort of people are we to be? And we've talked about the importance of balancing our head, heart and hands, informing the mind and trying to inflame the emotions as well as transform our behaviour. And if you miss out either part of that triangle, it's going to lead you down funny lines. So if you're someone who's just led by your head and your hands, in fact, just a minute, 2 minutes on the tables, see if you can do this. Head and hands, what does that lead to? What kind of person is just head and hands? What kind of person is heart and hands?
Heart and head. Fill in those little equations. See if you can work it out on the tables.
For 2 or 3 minutes before we get...
Okay.
So, if you've got head and hands, but no heart, what kind of person are you going to be?
In the middle.
All these are not rhetorical questions. Just say they. Middle table.
Tin Man in the Wizard of Oz. Nice. We could have. That's. Do they all work? This is interesting. Okay. And out of Oz, just did a.
In the Bible, would you be like Paris?
Thanks very much. And the. younger generation of Hortons taking out the more serious approach to the Bible. In the Bible, Pharisee would be a classic example of that. They've got good doctrine, remember the Pharisees. They do think the Bible is the word of God. And they act, Matthew 23, I think it is, where Jesus, woe to you, Pharisees. You know, one of his critiques of the Pharisees is, you'll go over land and ocean to win a single convert. They're doing world mission, the Pharisees. They are signed up to giving to mission partners and they're going abroad and they're not dodge, as it were. But ultimately, as Jesus says to them, you honour me with your lips, your heart's far from me. So sort of modern day equivalent, I guess is certainly a professing Christian who knows the right doctrine, turns up to the meetings, will be good at Wednesday night central attendance, will be tithing, possibly going on summer camp to help out, giving up their holiday for that. But the heart is not there. There's no, if you like, it's just a surface level. Jesus calls them whitewashed tombs. So everything's okay on the outside, but on the inside, there's no love for God. There's no care about sin. It's just a
shell.
What about heart and hands without the head? What kind of person is this?
Okay, just a minute. Let me guess. It is the scarecrow. Thank you.
heart and hands? Yep.
Okay, cool. So out of those two, driven by your feelings, so it's probably going to be your heart that's leading the way of the two of them. If you turn off head, then probably you're going to be an emotionally driven person. Yeah. What else might this sort of person be like, I suppose?
Probably very into, like, charismatic
stuff, helping people, but... could well be that. Could well be that. If you sort of lost the grip on the Bible's teaching, the Bible's doctrine, then probably you're going to be driven by what you see, and you see physical poverty before you see spiritual poverty. So classically, a more liberal Christian would be driven by this. They would really genuinely care for the poor. They'd want to do something about it, and they'd get stuck into it. And it's not necessarily just social action stuff. It's just that there's a lack of care about doctrine, I suppose. And this might also be the kind of really confused person who just knows that they're sold out for God. They love Jesus. He's rescued them. They want to do something for him, so they dash off and do everything. So they don't necessarily have to be liberal. They just could be. It's a kind of really keen 18-year-old who decides, man, the gospel's amazing. I'm going to become a missionary, and buys a plane ticket and goes to Brazil, and then thinks, eesh, what am I going to be doing? So there could be something quite nice about heart and hands with their head, but it's ultimately going to run out. At some point, you're going to crash without that. Heart and head. Maybe slightly trickier. We'll come back to what's tricky in a minute. But did anyone get anywhere on this one? Yeah, go on. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I think it's really good. This is almost like the mystic person, this really spiritual person. I really want to feel my relationship with God, and I'll study the Bible, and He'll speak to me, and I'll pray, and I don't know. But it's all about me. So it gets a bit sort of introverted in terms of, not necessarily in terms of personality, but just in terms of it's all about me and God, and actually the serving outside of my own little circle, less so. Yep. Anytime you ditch, well, basically anytime you prioritise head. And they could be massive. Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, it could be a real passionate theological arguer. They like to think and they like to go and bash down everybody who's different. Could just be the coward. So I feel the gospel's true. I feel, you know, hell is a terrible prospect. Heaven's a brilliant one. And I'm right in that, you know, I'm thinking correctly, but I just daren't actually go and speak to someone about it or do anything about it, or even to someone who's lazy. I know it's true, and my feelings to a decent degree are in line with that, but I just never actually get from the backside and do anything about it. Now, all of it, as maybe you discovered when you discussed it, that, of course, in reality, it's not possible to be two of the three. You couldn't be someone who was genuinely understood the gospel with your head and was on fire in your heart but didn't do anything. You couldn't be someone who, really felt genuine passion for God and for the world and went and did something about it and hadn't understood. Okay, so it's not actually possible to be two of the three. But as a diagnostic tool, as a way of just assessing yourself, most of us probably swerve towards one of those three. We're doers or we're thinkers or we're just sort of real feelers and spiritualists and all the rest of it. So the reason we put it in the 3D values is partly for the leadership, but also for the whole church. Just as a way of saying, actually, just a minute, are we verging off one way or another? You know, are we as a church just all about sort of teaching correctly and forgetting to actually do anything? Which is probably more our danger. Are we in just danger of running around to do a million things, but we never stop and actually study and think? And so I think it's quite a helpful way of just assessing where you're at and where the church is at. It might be worth saying too on those that it's, and I'm not sure we should think of ourselves as made up of three parts, a sort of a thinky part, my brain, a feeling part, my heart perhaps, and a sort of doing thing, my actions. When the Bible uses the word heart, it's not using it in the way that we use it today. So the Bible doesn't use heart really to mean the sort of touchy-feely part of you.
When the Bible uses the word heart, it tends to mean just the real you on the inside, the one that chooses and thinks and does stuff. So sometimes you think with your heart, interestingly, in the Bible. Sometimes you choose with your heart. So that's just a warning. When you see the word heart in the Bible, don't pour into it everything that our society means by heart. So really, I think the way to think about that triangle and those different head, heart, hands things is their perspectives on the whole you, okay, on the real you. So if you really, if you think about it, one of the commands in the Bible, so one of the things you're meant to do is to think. Okay? So if you push hard enough and try and be a person who does all the right stuff, one of the things you're told to do is meditate on the words of the Lord. Or to think and wrestle. Timothy's told to reflect on what Paul writes to him. One of the other things you're told to do is feel rightly. So actually, if you got any one of them really right, it would drive you to do the other ones too. Similarly, if you really felt horror at sin, well, you'd actually stop sinning. And again, just in the way the Bible presents itself to us, it does come from these different angles. So I think about that in Jeremiah. Jeremiah 2, that the problem with the people is idolatry. Now, God could have just said to his people, look, you are idolaters. I've explained about this. I've given you two pretty clear commandments on it. Idolatry is wrong. Okay, it's wrong because actually I'm more powerful than other gods. And he could have done a really logical presentation. But instead, he sends Jeremiah and he says this. Has a nation ever changed its gods, even though there are no other gods? But my people have changed their glory for that which does not profit. And here he goes. Be appalled, O heavens, at this. Be shocked. Be desolate. Shudder, declares the Lord. For my people have committed two sins. They've forsaken me, the fount of living waters, and turned to broken cisterns that can hold no water.
He says to them, be appalled, shudder. He's trying to evoke an emotional response, as it were. And the idea is that we're so appalled by the idea of turning away from God and drinking toilet water, is what he's saying to them. But it kind of provokes a different reaction to just a very clinical, sin is evil, don't do it. Now sometimes, maybe in some of Paul's letters, it's more clinical. But just the language of the Bible is meant to resonate often with our emotions. Now you think of it too, when Jesus talks about it's better to cut off your hand if it causes you to sin, or gouge out your eye rather than be thrown into the fires of hell. Where the worm never dies, or the fire is never quenched. It's deliberately not just coldly logical language. So that God wants us, I think, to feel as well as just to think the right way. Perhaps the best example of this, though, just in terms of orientating ourselves, in terms of how to know what kind of godliness looks like, what Christ-likeness looks like, is to look at the life of Christ. About 100-odd years ago now, there's a guy called Benjamin Warfield wrote an essay called The Emotional Life of Our Lord. And it's been a sort of classic passed down the centuries. And what I've done is I've just put some of the verses he uses there down in a list. I suggest maybe you do it in sort of twos and threes, split it up, turn up those passages and just answer those two questions. What emotion is on show from Jesus? And why does he feel that way? Okay, what's provoked it?
Maybe do that in pairs or threes and split the list up and then come back together and sort of share them across the group. What emotion and why does he feel that way? And then once you've compiled the whole list, as you look over these examples, what do you think we're meant to learn? Okay, why are we being told about Jesus' emotional reaction in these various circumstances? Happy? Cool. Go for it.
Okay. Let's just start with the examples. We're not going to go through them all because you've no doubt sorted them out. But did any of them particularly either surprise, confuse, stump you?
Are we happy on each of the tables with the list? Yes is a fine answer too. Yep.
Cool, brilliant. Okay, in which case, just general reflections. If you look down that list and the sort of various ways Jesus reacts,
What lessons do you think we're meant to learn from that? This group has got loads, so we'll start over here.
Yeah,
interesting. Okay, let's go over here. Yeah, for all those, slightly clearer. We felt them a bit more deeply, to be true.
It's interesting, he is moved by both physical and spiritual need, isn't he?
Mm.
And his response is both physical and spiritual.
Mm. Nice. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. Yeah. So it's a bit like the James one. He doesn't just say, I'll pray for you, and then off he goes. He does actually get stuck into the mess of it, essentially. Physical as well as spiritual. Yeah.
Even though as well, he knows that
yeah. Yeah, and so for us, you know, Jesus never sort of. I mean, the Lazarus one is a classic, isn't it? I mean, he knows he's about to, he's going to raise Lazarus. He knows, but he doesn't just walk in and go, remember Romans 8:28, all things work for the good of those who love him, so don't mourn, this will be fine. He weeps. So he genuinely is moved to compassion. The word is a sort of snorting like a horse, apparently. You know, he generally sort of like hates death. I think that's a really good point. And although obviously we don't have the same knowledge as Jesus, the danger is when you sort of realise that God's got everything in control and that at least for Christians it will all work out in the end, it can sort of almost use that as a way of immunising you against caring or feeling, as if either on behalf of other people, hey, buck up, it'll be fine in the end, so you know, you're all going to heaven, get on with it. Or feeling that that's what we should feel. You know, we go through some tragedy and we think, oh, I'm pretty sure Paul said rejoice always, so better not get upset. And it can be, yeah, well, it's just cruel.
We also said
exactly, yeah, it's selective use of scripture, certainly. I wrote down six sort of quick points, really, which I guess you may have covered. The first, I think it shows that Christlikeness involves emotional growth, okay, or involves being emotionally engaged in the world. Emotions are not intrinsically a bad thing. We weren't built to be just some logic machines. We are built to feel as well as to think and to do. I think John Piper uses an illustration of imagining a guy on his anniversary. Okay, if it was, I don't know, 25th wedding anniversary, and he comes home and he's brought his wife flowers. And 25th, maybe he's underdone it there, but 7th wedding anniversary, he's brought flowers, which is really going an extra mile. And he sort of uses the illustration. He says, you know, is it right that I buy my wife flowers on the 7th wedding anniversary? Well, yeah. Of course, it's the right thing to do. But if I hand them over and she says, oh, you know, John, why did you do this? You know, why have you done this? And I say, well, because it's the right thing to do. You've kind of missed something. You know, you hand them over because, you know, I love you and, you know, off you go. So It's that same with, I think it's the same with the, what Jesus models to us. Of course, he does the right thing, and the fact that we might not feel right doesn't excuse us not doing. Okay, sometimes we're so worried about not being a Pharisee, we're like, well, don't want to pray today because I just don't feel like it. It would just be hypocritical. I'm not going to Bible study because it would just be hypocritical. My heart's not in it. No, that's not quite right either. Sometimes you have to just slug through until the emotions catch up. A Pharisee is someone who doesn't care about engaging with the heart rather than someone who's just going through a dry patch. But nevertheless, for Jesus, the true man, remember, he's fully human. He really is emotionally engaged as well as just doing the right thing. It's, as we've picked up, important as we begin this series that we don't just think emotions is about being happy all the time. Sort of inane Christian tiggers bouncing around the place. You know, everything's wonderful because I'm a Christian. Jesus, fully human, weeps at death. He, you know, he's frustrated by the Pharisees. He's angry at sin. He's got a whole range of emotions. And if you read the Psalms, you get everything. Of course you get joy. But you also get real down times. You know, Christians, frankly, we'll come back to this at some point, but Christians get depressed. It's life's hard. We live in a fallen world, not heaven. So emotion does not equate to constantly smiling, constantly happy, bouncing around the 100-acre wood like a madman. The really interesting thing, I think, when you start thinking about Jesus' emotions is that he always reacts rightly. He also has the right emotional response. And I think this is something we probably do need to work on. I'm not saying that we watched Outnumbered last night. George and I watched an episode of Outnumbered. And in there, the mum goes to a funeral. And she just can't stop giggling. You know those situations where you know it's wrong to laugh, but you just can't help it. And it's kind of, and it's just an awful, it's a cringeworthy scene. She's sniggering away in the corner and everyone else is horrified. And that's a bit of an extreme. But as Christians, we can actually, I think there are times we emotionally react the wrong way to a situation. The one that sprung to mind for me was how quite often we find sin or sexual morality funny, okay, rather than being horrified at it. So we from whether it's TV or whatever, or friends joking around, I think at the cricket club, or just, the world obviously makes light of sin, and sexual sin in particular. And it laughs at it. And actually the pressure is, just you just laugh along, don't you? You sort of go with it. Whereas actually Jesus' reaction to sin is horror and shock. And now, again, that, you know, there are ways to play that. I'm not saying every time someone sort of says something offside, you run screaming out of the room. But in terms of how, what's our sort of instant response, finding sin funny, amusing, something's gone wonky there. Now, there'll be all sorts of different examples of that, but trying to make sure that our emotional response matches up with the right response is something I think Jesus does demonstrate. And linked to that, he always reacts with the right degree of emotion. It's something Bynum points out in the book, and I found really helpful. If on the same playing cricket on a Saturday afternoon, if I have a really good game and I do really well, I am absolutely over the moon. Okay, I really like cricket. Or if a team I support, you know, if England, I'm watching it, England win, I'm over the moon. That's fine. Okay, it's good to be happy if you do well at something. That's fine. But I am often far more excited, say at the end of a Six Nations match when England just or England beat New Zealand at rugby. Yeah, brilliant, over the moon. Am I that excited by what I've read in the Bible that morning? Nowhere near. My emotional response to something often gives away how much I care about it. And again, this is something we'll come back to it. And one of the things Barnum points out is that one of the things we need to learn and pray and sort of grow in is reacting to the right degree. So it's right to be happy at a sporting victory, but I should be even more amazed by grace or something. The funny little graph I've put down there is literally nicked straight out of his book. And he mocks himself a bit for writing a book on emotions, then drawing a graph. But he says, look, imagine the two axes. You've got emotion, okay, positive emotion, and then under at the bottom of the page, negative emotion. So happy, sad, bluntly, and then you've got events. Happy events to the right, birth of a child, passing exams, all the rest of it, and then sad events on the left, death and illness and all the rest. Now, his point is that we should be
reacting positively to positive events and negative to negative events. So that A floating up there in the sort of right-hand corner. I hear my best friend's just had a child, and so I'm happy. Well, that's right. Okay? But, or B, bottom left-hand corner, you know, my granddad's died, I'm sad. Okay? Pretty, so there's a sort of an obvious link there, I suppose. You know, good events make you happy, sad events make you sad. That's how things should work. And they should more or less be in proportion. So something that's slightly less positive as an event, so a bit nearer the middle of the cross, you know, I don't know, won 20 quid on the Grand National in a work pool. That's absolutely fine. I'm quite pleased about that, but I'm nowhere near as pleased, obviously, as as whatever. Now, what this is actually, what you've got to start watching out for yourself is, and very easily happens, is both that you have disproportionately overreact. So my relationship ended, I get dumped. Okay, of course you're going to be sad. Okay, you'll be human if you didn't get sad. But sometimes people go plunging off the bottom of the graph. So the negative emotion is right down at the bottom to an event that actually is nowhere near as serious as some other things in life. So the scale, the sort of intensity of your emotion is, for some of us, something we need to work on. Not being so excited by things that are less important and so devastated by things that are also less significant. Essentially, God, if you like, and the gospel and serving other people should be so big in our emotions that actually those are the things that really move me. And that just means recalibrating for most of us. None of us instantly do this rightly. And of course, the other danger is to watch out for is that our emotions are often giveaways of sin. So bottom right-hand corner, that little C, okay? There's two guys, they both fancy the same girl, and one of them starts going out with him, with her, and it's a positive event, happy event, you know, my mate has just got himself a girl, so it should be a happy event, so I should more or less be happy about it, but I'm so jealous and bitter that actually, I just get bitter and jealous. What that's doing is giving away that I cared far too much about having a girlfriend or whatever it might be, about getting that particular girl. See, emotions often give away what we desire too strongly. I think in the book, or I might have heard this elsewhere, he gives an example too of reacting sort of actually quite positively to a negative event. So there's a girl who was saying that she, every time her sister got a promotion, she obviously smiled, you know, oh, congratulations, you know, around the dinner table with the family, but inside she was burning with anger. So jealous, so resentful of her sister. So again, what's that doing? It's her emotional reaction is giving away something far more important. Either her lack of love for her sister or her prizing of her own reputation or whatever it might be. Point really is that our emotions are meant to happen, they're real, but they're meant to be in proportion. And often they give away what's going on underneath. And just finally there as well, which I think was brought up in one of the groups, the Gethsemane example. Jesus in Gethsemane in Mark 14. I'll just look it up. My soul is sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch. He falls on the ground. Father, Abba Father, all things are possible for you. Remove this cup from me. Yet not what I will, but what you want. He's in agony, okay, emotional torment. He knows, he's sort of seeing the fullness of what he's about to go through. It's going to be horrific. He's going through the intensity of hell, Baron's God's wrath. It's about to happen. And that, you know, you get all screwed up before an exam or you get all screwed up before a driving test or something. But imagine knowing this is coming towards you. Okay, it's terrifying. So his emotions are saying, run, stop it, just get out of here. But he doesn't let his emotions control him. So there are, it's the more we think about it, it's quite complex in a way because Jesus is right, he's never done anything wrong, he doesn't feel wrong, so he's right to be horrified, overwhelmed, scared, even terrified. I'm careful what I say there, but certainly to see this and feel this as a traumatic event that's on the horizon for him. But he does not let his emotions dictate
And again, as we go on, that's something we're going to need to sort of think through and talk about. Some of you are just much more emotional than others, and your natural reaction is to go with what you feel. But the Gethsemane story, you know, whilst it tells us far more, one of the things it tells us is that sometimes the right way to walk, the God-honoring way to walk, is to actually not be led or driven primarily by our first level, as it were, emotional feelings. So
that was, which is the last things I got down. Emotions don't control him, or at least he's willing to walk into negative feelings for the sake of a greater good.
We ought to wrap up. Just one last comment, really, which is that all this stuff on emotions, we just need to be a little bit careful. My one fear about it is that we get into it, we like think about it, and we, you know, talk about it, we pray about it. But we get our target slightly skew if. It's easy, I think, or dangerous to think, I want to get better at all this emotion stuff so that I will feel better. Okay? So my primary target, is to feel good, to feel better. And if God's going to help me feel better, or the gospel, or Jesus, hey, I'll take anything. My primary aim is to feel better, feel happy. Now, joy is one of the emotions, of course, a good thing to feel. And ultimately, the way the world's moving, the gospel's moving, is towards happiness. Okay? In heaven, you're going to be fully happy. No sadness in heaven. But what's actually important for now, for earth, is that we feel rightly, if you like. It's not that I use God to make me happy. It's that I need my emotions to be emotions that honour the Lord. Sometimes that will involve joy. Sometimes that actually involve maybe horror at my sin. Think of Proverbs. You know, five things God's... This is a paraphrase, I'm afraid. There are six things God hates, seven things he detests. Proud eyes, a haughty manner. You know, this isn't all about feeling good. And it's not that I use God to get emotional. It's that I, in my emotions, honour God.
Good.
That's been quite a broad introduction. We've only got about 5 minutes left. But what we'll do over the future weeks is to start to explore some of these different pathways for a couple of weeks. And then what we're going to do in the sort of second half, if you like, is look at some emotions. We'll look at sort of feeling down. Okay, what does the Bible say about depression and sadness and the rest of it? We'll look at fear and worry. We'll look at some specific emotions in about 3 or 4 weeks' time. Good to pray to close, though. Round your tables. Praying some lessons from tonight. And if you run out, then there's plenty to pray for at church. There's a moving venue, losing people. Last few prayers today.